as we'll see, these debates from previous generations also have fascinating contemporary halachic ramifications, even the ones from the past centuries. So we begin our discussion. If you don't have the handout, I can show you with mine. We begin our discussion with the use of a particular medicine in the 16th century. This medicine was actually called mumia. Now, you might recognize the name a little bit. Does it sound like anything you're familiar with? Sounds like mummy. Sounds like Egyptian mummy. And the truth of the matter is, it is directly related to Egyptian mummy. And I'll share with you a little bit of the history of this particular medicinal substance and the interesting debate that ensued in the 16th century. So we're familiar from our historical context that both Yaakov and Yosef, at least the Torah says, Vayichantu, that there's some form of embalming. It's a matter of debate as to whether they were fully embalmed in the entire Egyptian form of embalming, or whether it was a modified form of embalming, which many say, because of the Isurim involved in the embalming process. If you ever read in detail the embalming process, they eviscerate the internal organs, make an incision in the abdomen, remove all the organs from the abdomen. They remove actually the brain through the nostrils. They actually developed instruments in ancient Egypt which were able to extract the brain through the nostrils. Similar instruments, by the way, are used to this very day in pituitary tumor extraction, or some neurosurgeries where they can access the brain actually through the nasal cavity. But in any case, this medicinal substance, which was a mineral, a black mineral, similar to asphalt, which was mined in areas of modern-day Iraq, areas of what would be today the Dead Sea, was considered to have tremendous medicinal qualities, to such an extent that the Egyptians co-opted this material into their embalming process. And they used this mumia substance in the embalming process because if it had such great medicinal value during life, perhaps it would have great medicinal value in the afterlife as well. So if you visit any Egyptian mummies today, if you're not Kohanim, so there are a number of museums across the world today where you can actually see ancient Egyptian mummies. I don't know if any of you have ever visited. Metropolitan Museum of Art has Egyptian mummies. The British Museum has Egyptian mummies. The museum in Turin, the Egyptian Museum in northern Italy, has Egyptian mummies. If you see mummies that have been unraveled, you see that they are black. They are not black because of the age. They are black because of the substance which was used for embalming. The substance was called mum or mumia. And in fact, the substance was identified with the embalming process to the extent that the body that was embalmed was called a mummy. And the etymology of mummy and mumia are related. What happened in a fascinating transference over the period of time, there was a transference of the medicinal value of this mineral, which was mined from the ground, to the actual body, which was embalmed with the substance, to the extent that by the time we reached the Middle Ages, there was a belief that if you ingested or used ancient Egyptian mummy, this would be of great medicinal value. So people actually went to Egypt to try and find ancient Egyptian mummies to extract this substance to use for medicinal value. And if you were a Jew in ancient Egypt, or in Egypt in the Middle Ages, in the 1500s, turns out the Jews had a big role in the mumia industry in the 1500s. And one very famous rabbinic figure, his name is Rav David ben Zimra, the Radbaz, was the chief rabbi of Egypt at that time, and he functioned in a number of cities in Egypt, in Alexandria and Cairo. And the question was asked to him if it would be halachically permissible for two questions. For his congregation to use this substance, because after all, it's derivative from the human body, from the corpse. Would there be a prohibition of deriving benefit from the body? Would there be a prohibition of nivul ames, etc., etc.? And question number two, can members of his congregation do business with this substance? because they're deriving benefit from the corpse of a human body. And some of them were Kohanim. And if you're a Kohen, you're not allowed to be exposed to a corpse that generates or confers tumah. Is this a prohibition which they shouldn't be exposed to? So he answered the question. You'll see, actually, if you don't have the handout, there are some in museums across the world. There are still some containers of the ancient Egyptian mummy from the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and these little containers say a mumia on it. We'll come back to this in a moment. There's another one of the vials which say another word on it, which has relevance for the history of this substance, mumia. So this was a major debate in Egypt in the 1500s. Is it permissible to use this substance? Is it not permissible to use this substance? What did the Radbaz do? The Radbaz did what physicians and rabbis do today in the 21st century. First, clarify the medicine. Once you've clarified the medicine, then you can answer the shaila. So what did he do? He went to the local pharmacist. He says, how do you make this substance? What do you do from the time that you harvest this mumia to the time that it appears on the shelf in this little container? What is the process? So they said they extract it, they grind it, they mix it with cinnamon and myrrh and a whole host of spices so that it's largely dissociated from its original form. So he actually paskin, the Radbaz, that A, it's halachically permitted to use, not only for pikuach nefesh purposes, but even for non-pikuach nefesh purposes. And furthermore, it would still potentially convey tumah if the people dealing in this stuff were Kohanim. But in order for it to convey tumah, it had to have the requisite volume to convey tumah, and it's unlikely that any single vial of mumia would contain the requisite volume. I mean, the factory of mumia may indeed have contained the requisite volume, but not for any individual salesman per se. Rabbi Yaakov Castro in Ginas Varadim in Yoredeya, he was the opposition, and he said, absolutely not. And whereas the Radbaz had said that the medicinal value of this substance is not from the human corpse, it's from the spices, he said that the medicinal value is actually from the human corpse. As such, it would absolutely be usur for anybody to benefit from such a thing. And even benefit, there's a debate, which is not for our discussion now. The Radbaz says that isur of hana'ah from the corpse, if it's done in shelo kederech hana'aso, in an unusual and different fashion, then that would be something which might be more permissible. Rav Yaakov Castro disagreed on that particular point as well. What happened in this major debate? What happened to the mummy trade? So here's what happened to the mummy trade. What happened was something which never happens in Jewish business. There was a scandal. What was the scandal? The scandal was there was a tremendous amount of demand for mumia, but as you can well imagine, very little supply. How many Egyptian mummies could there be to supply people who wanted this substance? Not very many. So what people would do is they would take freshly deceased bodies, put them out in the sands of the Sahara, and allow them to desiccate in the sun to mimic mumia and make the substance from these bodies. And in fact, if you look on your handout, if you have, whereas one of the containers says Mumia Alexandria, the other container says Mumia Ver. Mumia Ver, for those of you who speak Latin, Greek, means genuine certified mumia, as opposed to fraudulent mumia. So today it would have an OU or a Chafke or something along those lines. But this was to tell you that they were not using the fraudulent mummy. So what happened to the mummy trade? What happened to the mummy trade is there was one businessman, it was a Jewish businessman, who was using the fraudulent mummy, and one of his disgruntled employees disclosed this fact to the king of Egypt. The king of Egypt got very upset that he was using fraudulent mummy and imposed a tremendous tax on the trade. Very shortly thereafter, the entire trade dissipated. And by the way, I once gave this talk about mumia, and there was a woman in the audience from Uzbekistan. And she came over to me afterwards, and she said, I want you to know, my husband and I came here to the United States. My husband had an illness no doctors could diagnose, suffering terribly. So what did I do? I sent back to my native country for mumia. and they sent me these tablets of mumia. The tablets are pitch black, just like they would have been 2,000 years ago or 500 years ago. She said he took the mumia substance and he was magically cured from all his ailments. So you see, this notion of mumia is still perpetuated till this very day. I suspect the mumia that she received from Uzbekistan was not derivative from the human corpse. I suspect it was back to the old ancient mineral form of mumia. But nonetheless, the word is perpetuated. The therapies, at least the mineral therapies, have been perpetuated as well. We move to our next debate. We're moving along chronologically. Our next debate, we find ourselves in the 17th and 18th century, in a debate which we alluded to in our discussions previously, and that is the debate of the three-day burial controversy. Anyone here familiar with the three-day burial controversy? Handful of you are familiar. This controversy is the predecessor to the contemporary brain death debate. This really is the progenitor, if you will, of our modern discussions, which we've discussed incessantly here in this conference, the definition of death. How so? Here was the issue. The issue was that in the mid-1500s and 1600s, scientists and physicians began to realize that doctors were misdiagnosing death. That sometimes people were thought to be dead, but in fact were not. To such an extent that they actually believed maybe we should wait to bury people, because perhaps some people may be buried alive. And this became a tremendous fear, a fear which was expressed in literature as well. Edgar Allan Poe, for example, The Telltale Heart, and others, where people wrote about the fact that people could potentially be buried alive. And there were reports of coffins that had been exhumed, and they opened up the lid of the coffin and they saw scratch marks on the inside of the coffin, reflecting that people had actually survived. And entrepreneurs took advantage of this. And if you have the handout, I'll show you if you don't. Some entrepreneurs developed these creative mechanisms. It's a little small, but I'll explain it to you. It's a mechanism whereby they would bury you underground, but to address the fear of premature burial, they would connect your fingers and toes and nose to a pulley system, and the pulley system would in turn be connected to a bell tower above the grave. And if you were to wake underground, you would ring the bell, hence the term saved by the bell. That is the original origin of the term saved by the bell. I'm sorry? Right, it's boxing too, of course. And also in class, when you're in high school, you also saved by the bell.
How about
I'm sorry?
Oh,
a dead ringer. So is that also perhaps...
You think it's linked,
right. Could be. Definitely could be. So this presented a major dilemma for the Jewish community because the concern for premature burial was so great that some countries actually legislated that it was prohibited to bury any human body after death for 3 days out of the concern that the patient might actually still be alive. And this presented a major problem for the Jewish community for the following reason. For us, as we've learned here many times over, not only prohibited to desecrate the body, but after the body dies, you have an obligation to bury the body. Lo talimi lo so'al o'etz. You can't delay burial at all. And while here in the United States, we sometimes delay burial for reasons to fly for funerals and things like that. In Israel, for example, in Yerushalayim, they bury 24 hours a day. If somebody passes away in the evening or late night, the burial will be in the middle of the night. Because of this tremendous concern and sensitivity for delay of burial, the biblical prohibition of delay of burial. And interestingly, one of the people who addressed the Jewish community and made it a big problem for the Jewish community was a man by the name of Olaf Tikson. Olaf Tikson told the Duke of Mecklenburg in Germany, which is one of the first areas to legislate that burial would be delayed, He said to him, I want you to know these Jews, they are not delaying burial. They are burying right away. And you need to do something about this. You need to go to the Jewish community and make sure that they delay their burial like everybody else. This fellow, Olaf Tixon, for whom we have no picture, but interestingly, we have a silhouette. The only picture we have of him is a silhouette. He happened to have been a professor at a medical school, the University of Butzau, which is a German medical school, lasted only a couple decades. And he actually encountered a Jewish medical student at this university, whose name was Marcus Moses. And he mentored this Jewish medical student. And in fact, this Jewish medical student wrote his papers as a medical student under the tutelage and under the mentorship of this Olaf Gerhard Tixon. He had a very interesting relationship with the Jews and the Jewish community. This fellow was so interesting that he's one of possibly two people ever to, as a non-Jew, receive some form of smicha. He had such breadth of knowledge of rabbinic literature and Hebrew that there's a rabbi that actually gave him a smicha.
In the second person.
I don't remember who the second person is. Yeah, Jay wants to know. I'll find that out for you. Definitely find that out. You gave me my homework. And in fact, when this Jewish medical student graduated, in his dissertation, he wrote a lengthy Hebrew letter praising this student, saying he's one of the greatest students that he's had. And furthermore, he intervened at his graduation ceremony to allow him to take the oath, which was normally taken with some Christian reference, specifically to take the oath on the Ten Commandments and on the Torah, as opposed to taking a Christian oath. But at the same time, he was also against the Jewish community, and perhaps even some say that his relationship with this student was really an attempt to proselytize this student, which was really unsuccessful.
Yeah, I wonder if the three-day wake the Christians observed.
So the question is the three-day wake? The answer is yes, it is directly related to this. The concept of a wake and keeping the body above ground is directly related to this concern about the misdiagnosis of death.
The word wake come from that?
The word, the etymology of the word, I'm not sure. It makes sense, obviously. If they would wake, you want to make sure they don't wake. Right, that would definitely make sense, but I don't know specifically what it is, but it clearly makes sense.
Better to be seen than viewed.
Better to be seen than viewed, right. Which reminds me of the joke, what does every Jew hope they say about him at his funeral? Look, he's moving. So this became a major issue for the Jewish community, and if you have the handout, there were two major players initially. Ultimately, this became the brain death of the 18th century. Every major rabbinic figure of that period of time weighed in on this discussion, whether it's halachically permissible to delay the burial, not to delay the burial. The two major figures that initially became involved were Yaakov Emden and Moses Mendelssohn. Yaakov Emden said it would not be permitted to delay, and we're not going to go into all the detailed halachic analysis. And they actually asked Moses Mendelssohn to intervene on behalf of the Jewish community because he was much more literate in the German language, and they would probably accept his writings more than they would accept Yaakov Emden's writings, which he did, and he actually got a special exemption for the Jewish community. But
he wrote a letter to Rabbi Yaakov Emden.
But he himself...
Right, wrote to Emden, what do you think about the Germans are right?
So he actually believed personally that maybe the Germans were right, because after all, if you think about it logically, what was the reason for a delay of burial? The reason for a delay of burial was not for any frivolous reason. The reason was for pikuach nefesh, because they genuinely thought the person was alive. By the way, this delay of burial issue was the impetus for the question to the Chassam Sofer, which was a number of decades later. But the famous Chassam Sofer, which has been discussed at this conference about the definition of death and how death is to be defined, was initiated because of this issue. What was the initial question to the Chassam Sofer? The question to the Chassam Sofer was, if a Kohen physician is asked to be the one to visit the body after initial death in order to confirm death subsequently, is he allowed to go and do that? So let's say a person was diagnosed dead at point A. are you allowed to go? And they needed a physician to go the first day, the second day, the third day to confirm that death had actually ensued. What do you think, by the way, if you had to imagine, what would be criteria that would indicate complete irreversible death? Any thoughts? Rigor mortis and gangrene. Gangrene and rigor mortis were the two irreversible signs of death. Once a person developed those, then they would be sufficient. By the way, one of the sources that Mendelssohn mentioned and others mentioned, right, that's true. But I guess in the context of somebody who has no other signs of life and begins to develop gangrene, I guess in that context, it would be assumed that it was as a cause of death. But you're correct. You could have gangrene in the living as well. And one of the sources that Mendelssohn invoked, by the way, was the following source. I have it here in English translation from the Tractate of Smachos. It says, we go out to the cemetery and watch over the dead for 30 days. This is from the Mishnah. This is a Jewish source. We go and visit the dead for 30 days, and there is no concern for darkei emori. They would go and visit the cemetery to make sure to see if a person was still alive. And you're going to ask me, how is that possible? Cemetery people are buried underground. What is visiting a cemetery going to determine if they're alive or not? And the Mishnah continues, there was once a case when one was visited and found to be alive. And he lived more than 25 years and had 5 sons. Which indicates that at least once, there was one case of a misdiagnosis of death. So the question is, how is that possible? What is the context of visiting a cemetery and being able to diagnose or determine that someone was in fact actually not dead? So the answer is, they were probably visiting what are called kuchin, or what's the English translation for... above ground graves or burial coves, mausoleum. Yeah, the ossuary actually is the bone box. Ossuary is a slightly different thing. But they had.
Dr. William H. Jerusalem in Harmony Hood, they're building mausoleum, they're building in the ground, in the rock.
Right. So it's a major issue which is going on in Israel right now, which I'm sure by Dr. Steinberg is involved in. There's simply not enough space for burial, so they're actually building up, they're building down, trying to find ways to halachically connect it to the ground so it fits all the halachic criteria, but they're building things similar to this. But the kuchin were used in ancient times for the following reasons. If people died, for example, far away from their family plot, today, what would happen in that situation? You'd get on a plane, you'd take the body on a plane and transfer the plane to another, to the family plot in Israel or in America, whatever it may be, and the patient would be buried. In times of antiquity, if somebody died far away, it was impossible to put the body on a wagon and transport it days or weeks to another location because the body would decompose on the way. So that was prohibitive. So what did they do? They actually put the body in a local location, in one of these kuchin, which were basically caves with the holes bored into the cave. It would take a number of months for the body to decompose. Then they would take the bones and put them, as Laser said, into an ossuary. An ossuary is a bone box. And when they discovered initially these ossuaries, they didn't know what they were. You know, it's basically a casket, which is about this big. So they thought maybe all these people in the ancient world were midgets, because all the boxes were small. Turned out they were just used to transport bones. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch talks about this as well. It's called likud atzamos. When they would take the bones and move them from one location to another location, you actually would have to sit shiva for that one day. So I thought about this halacha, and I'll get to your question in a second. When they recently recovered the body of Zecharia Baumel, Olav Shalom, a remarkable tale of Israel's persistence in Kavod HaMeis, which is beyond any existing nation. So I don't know the specifics, but I assume the family probably had to sit a day of Shiva when they transferred the remains of the body to Israel for burial. Yes?
So Beit Alpha is an example of what you're talking about, where Rabbi Yehuda and the seals were catacombs underground. They buried him in once the body decomposed, they put him in ossuaries, sarcophagi. If you go to Ben Alpha, which is where Rabbi Yudan and the Caesar, you'll see exactly what you're describing.
Right, or Kever Malachim is another one of these examples. Right, so you'll see in Israel, you'll find a number of these examples. That's exactly how that was buried. So how was this let's move on to the next controversy, but how was this controversy ultimately resolved? So ultimately, the preponderance of rabbinic opinion was that even though the physicians wanted to delay burial and declare the patient alive, which is sort of an interesting twist, it's converse of what's going on today. The physicians wanted to delay the burial. The physicians said the patient's still alive. The halachic response was that from our perspective, we've been diagnosing death for thousands of years. We have criteria about the definition of death. We maintain our criteria for that definition of death. We'll bury immediately based on those criteria, no matter what the scientists believe. And again, this is obviously much more to discuss in terms of the sources and analysis of this. It turns out, by the way, that this very few, if any, cases ever were found of people who actually awoke after initial diagnosis of death, and it turned out to be an unjustified fear. Let's move now into moving into the 20th century, and our third debate is the debate on abortion. And what stimulated this debate? What stimulated this debate is one particular disease that is found prevalent in the Jewish community, and that is a disease called Tay-Sachs. Now, how many people here have actually seen a case of Tay-Sachs? So you have one hand, two hands, three hands, four hands, five hands. Now, if I would have asked this question 30, 40 years ago, many, many more hands would have gone up. And in fact, I'm sure it was the case in Eretz Yisrael and here in America. There were entire wards filled with Tay-Sachs children in Brooklyn. I'm sorry. Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim, specifically the Ashkenazi Jewish community, absolutely correct. This disease, just a little history of Tay-Sachs, why it's called Tay-Sachs, for those of you who are not familiar, it's actually a hyphenated definition, hyphenated term. It's Tay-Sachs. Actually, two independent physicians. One was Warren Tay, who was an ophthalmologist, who diagnosed a very unique ophthalmological condition in children who had severe disability, the cherry red spot. And that was back in the late 1880s. He published in the Transactions of the Ophthalmological Society. And roughly around the same time, there was another physician, Bernard Sachs, who published an article in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease on arrested cerebral development with special reference to its cortical pathology, identifying other associations with what turned out to be the very same disease. So they ended up calling the disease Tay-Sachs disease. What is fascinating about Tay-Sachs disease is it's the very first disease ever in the history of medicine for which a genetic cause was found. And from our perspective, it's no coincidence that it just happens to be a disease associated with the Ashkenazi Jewish community, which happens to be the very first disease associated with a genetic cause. So when they first identified this, the discussions, they were able to identify the carrier, the adult carrier, and then subsequently they were able to identify the fetus in utero, if the fetus actually was afflicted with Tay-Sachs or not. Then the question became, and this is an important halakhic question at that period of time, whether one could perform this test when one was pregnant in order to identify the presence of this particular genetic abnormality, and if one identified this genetic abnormality, would it be halakhically permissible to perform an abortion? And this is one of the greatest great debates over the last few decades in the world of Jewish medical ethics, a debate also that we have discussed here in this conference in a number of different guises. And famously, of course, there's more nuance to this, but famously the polar extreme positions that came out in that period of time were of Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, who maintained that abortion was akin to homicide from a halachic perspective and would be prohibited even if a woman was found to be carrying a Tay-Sachs-afflicted fetus. And as such, since it would be prohibited to perform an abortion, from his perspective, there was also no reason to do the test to begin with to do the amniocentesis or the chorionic villi sampling is you couldn't act on the results. And on the other polar extreme was the Tzitz Eliezer of Oldenburg Zatzal, who said, based on his analysis, who had a different analysis of the prohibition of abortion from a halachic perspective, and as such, he said it would be permitted to perform an abortion if the fetus was afflicted with Tay-Sachs, even up to the to a relatively late period in the gestational phase of the woman. What has changed now in the 21st century? So we alluded to this today, whereas the discussion back then was, is it permitted to perform an abortion or not? And for people who conceive naturally, fast forward to the 21st century. Now, for people who are carriers of Tay-Sachs or similar recessive genes, it is now possible to do something which we discussed earlier today called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. In a case of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, for those of you who have the handout, you can see a picture over there. You take the fertilized embryo, and you can extract one cell from the human embryo. And if you have a couple that are both carriers for Tay-Sachs disease, they can produce a number of fertilized embryos. You can test all the embryos to see which ones have Tay-Sachs, which ones are afflicted with Tay-Sachs, which ones are not afflicted with Tay-Sachs. And you can choose to implant those that are not afflicted with Tay-Sachs. So the interesting question now, and it's a question which is up for some debate, is it preferable to prospectively become pregnant naturally and consider the possibility of abortion? Or is it preferable to perform pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and conceive in a so-called unnatural fashion, which, by the way, would also involve using some form of contraception throughout the marriage? That's one interesting halachic question which is up for discussion. And the other interesting question, which poskim are now beginning to talk about, and has been discussed in the secular world as well, is now that we have the technology to prevent the birth of a child with Tay-Sachs or any other severe genetic disease, does it now become obligatory to utilize this technology to prevent the birth of a child with genetic disease? So that a couple who are both carriers of a genetic disease may possibly be mechuyev, not just an option to undergo pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but maybe, at least there's a havamina thought process, that maybe they would be obligated to do such a thing, this way to prevent the possibility of a child born with this disease. Is this something that any of the... I know some postgame are entertaining this as a possibility. Is anyone actually...
I don't know anyone that...
The mommy says... It's definitely coming up. And on the another aspect of abortion, which is very interesting in the 21st century, which we're going to follow as we move forward, is the following. In the discussion about abortion, gestational ages have relevance. So one of the major gestational phases for which there is a halachic distinction, at least according to some poskim, not all, is the 40-day gestational phase. The Gemara says in a number of places that a fetus that's less than 40 days gestation, now remember, when you say 40 days gestation, it means 40 days from conception, not the secular way of determining gestational age, which is from last menstrual period. It's a different calculation. So 40 days gestation, the Gemara says the fetus is considered maya ba'alma, it's considered mere water. So whereas Rav Moshe Feinstein does not consider this to have any halachic relevance in his decision, other poskim make this distinction and say, if an abortion would be permitted, it's less objectionable to perform that abortion less than 40 days gestation. The problem has been that our methods of assessing the genetic disability of a child haven't really been able to provide conclusive information before this 40-day period. It's right around the cusp of the 40-day period, maybe a little more than the 40-day period. So it hasn't really had too much halachic practical application. But that may change in the near future, and this might radically change the landscape of all the abortion discussions. And that might change with a testing which is called non-invasive prenatal testing or cell-free fetal DNA. And let me explain what that is. This is pretty exciting, not only from the halachic perspective, from the secular perspective as well. Until now, and this is not, it's been going on for the last couple of years, but continuing to develop. Previously, it was only possible to identify the genetics of the fetus by literally putting a needle into the abdomen of a woman and extracting, either from the amniotic fluid or from the chorionic villi, some kind of genetic material. But now scientists realize the following. It has generally been thought that the circulation of the mother and the circulation of the fetus are entirely separate. And that is largely true. However, occasionally a few cells will migrate from the fetal circulation into the maternal circulation. And the scientists are able to isolate these cells from the peripheral circulation of the mother. So literally from a blood test, with a needle in the arm, in the vein, they can extract a handful or even one single fetal cell. And if they can extract that fetal cell, they can derive genetic information from that cell. As it stands now, the amount of information they can obtain and the time that they can obtain this is limited. But the anticipation is that they'll be able to obtain this information at a phase less than 40 days gestation and might ultimately be able to isolate an entire fetal cell and do an entire genomic analysis on that fetal cell even before 40 days gestation. And for those who hold that this 40-day gestational difference has halachic significance, this could radically change the landscape of abortion. You'll be able to identify many different genetic diseases before this 40-day abortion.
Can CRISPR technology at this point be used to actually alter the genetic makeup to eradicate the data?
So CRISPR, not in practice yet, but in theory, CRISPR would be an alternate form of adjusting the genetic issues of a fetus. So, for example, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis simply identifies which embryo has the disease and then implants the one that doesn't. CRISPR would actually take the embryos, let's say all the embryos you have are afflicted with the disease and you don't have any embryos that are disease-free, then you could potentially use CRISPR to gene edit whatever defect was in that embryo, again, all in theory, and then implant that as well. So
that would that be halakhically preferable, let's say, than testing the embryo that has it and not doing whatever the embryo after that?
So which one would be halakhically preferable? In both cases, you'd have to produce the embryos outside the body. You'd have to procure the sperm and procure the egg. CRISPR versus PGD, I'm not sure if anyone would be specifically more preferable than the other. It's going to take time to see if CRISPR technology continues to evolve. Yes?
Does halacha really address what would be considered a disease? So where you draw the line, that's a disease that we need to prevent, and that's human.
So the question is, does halacha identify what a genetic disease is? So the truth is, and this is something that Rabbi Dr. Steinberg deals with on a very frequent basis, especially in the PGD section of Shaare Tzedek Hospital, what meets the threshold of severe disease that would allow someone to undergo PGD and what doesn't? So we can take the polar extremes. We can take the Tay-Sachs, which clearly meets the criteria for severe genetic disease. On the other side of the coin, you can take genetic enhancements, which clearly, for height or intelligence or things like that, which clearly don't meet the criteria for the use of something like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Then you have all the diseases, the entire spectrum in the middle, Down syndrome, clearly in that big chasm. You ask an excellent question. No simple answer to that question. But one thing which is clear, it's going to create a lot of complexity in the landscape of abortion. And especially if they're moving towards this, and by the way, some places are even beginning to do this. So right now, the testing that's being done on the fetus, either ultrasound testing, blood testing, genetic testing, is relatively limited. What some people are suggesting and will become possible is to do entire genome testing entire genome testing on the fetus. And there's no question that we're moving in that direction. There's no question we're going to be there in a relatively short period of time. The problem from our perspective is your concern, the slippery slope concern. So you're going to get a readout from a genomic analysis of your fetus, which will say you have a predisposition to X, Y, and Z. You're the carrier of A, B, and C. And by the way, you have 100 genes of unknown clinical significance, which could be fatal or could be beneficial. We have no idea. So it could be a potential disaster, and for the concern for abortion, which is our concern and our entire community's concern, if a woman is pregnant and presented with this information, it could potentially lower the threshold for wanting to perform an abortion, and especially if they could get this information before 40 days, it might start opening the floodgates of people wanting to have abortions when halakhically wouldn't be sanctioned. Yes. Right. So our threshold should be very high to share that information. We should only really share that information for diseases for which we have a definitive diagnosis and a definitive cure. Once you start opening it to these ambiguous diagnoses, then it's a disaster. But on the positive side, there are physicians that are beginning to do genomic testing on children after they're born, and they are finding predisposition genes or finding things that aren't routinely tested for, which could genuinely help the health of the child at an early developmental age. So we are in this stage. We are amassing an immense amount of information, reams and reams and exponential amounts of information. The challenge is getting gradually greater in terms of how to assimilate all this information, but it's the challenge of our generation. Yes. Excellent question. There are legal protections just for this reason, which are in place to prevent insurance companies from obtaining this information. But in the world of public information, when as we said, Dani Shapiro could find out who her real genetic father was in 36 hours using the internet at home, the likelihood of your insurance company being able to find some information relevant to your insurance policy on their own is potentially there, and there's no question that they would probably take advantage of that. So that is a fear that we need to protect also. So let's see if we can do one more chapter before we have Kabbal Shabbos. Kabbal Shabbos, what time? 7:15.
You know, when I get insurance forms now, some of them say that we're not allowed to disclose genetic information on the insurance forms.
So the insurance forms say itself that they can't obtain genetic information, you mean?
I cannot obtain genetic.
It's a new law in Canada. It's new in Canada.
Not let me just share with you, by the way, just food for thought, the flip side of that, that if you have people who have genetic predisposition to disease and they're not divulging this information to the insurance company, and the insurance company doesn't adjust their premiums accordingly, then what ultimately happens is these individuals end up using an immense amount of the insurance money, and the ones that end up paying for it are the other people in the insurance. So it's not such a simple equation. Your initial gut reaction is, let's not share the genetic information, but it may actually ultimately be helpful on a community level to share that information and maybe distribute the equity of or the burden of that information across a broader group of people. So just food for thought on that one. So I think our last one we'll discuss is the following debate, and this is a debate which we actually alluded to in the story of Inheritance, the book Inheritance, and the story of Dani Shapiro. Just to remind you, for those of you who weren't at that particular session, there's a book that just came out a few months ago by an author by the name of Dani Shapiro. It's a woman who comes from an Orthodox Jewish upbringing. She actually performed, the ancestry DNA test, and she found out that, as opposed to her ancestry, both sides being Ashkenazi Eastern Europe, she only found that she was 50% of Ashkenazi European history. And it turns out that her father, whom she thought was her biological father, was actually not her biological father. What was the scenario? The scenario was her parents suffered from infertility, and they suffered from male infertility, and they needed to get a donor in order for the woman to become pregnant, because the father had no viable sperm whatsoever. So this is one of the other major debates in the history of Jewish medical history. Is it permitted to introduce a sperm donor into the marriage? And if it's permitted to introduce a donor into the marriage, is it halachically preferable to use a Jewish donor or to use a non-Jewish donor? So if you think about it, it all depends on phrasing, all depends on how you put the words together. If you have a scenario of a husband and wife, and the woman gives birth to a child from the seed of another man, what does that sound like to you? Sounds like adultery, sounds like mamzerus. And in fact, on one side of this debate was the Satmar Rebbe, who was very adamant against any of this technology whatsoever, but specifically introducing the reproductive seed of someone else into the marriage. And based on psukim and other analyses, he actually indeed considered this to be an act of adultery and the resultant child to be a halachic mamzer, to be a halachic bastard. Oh, so is there a difference whether fertilized out or fertilized in? As long as the woman is receiving reproductive seed from another man, actually, to such an extent, some even said the OBGYN would be guilty of adultery by performing the insemination.
Are you making a distinction between implanting sperm to the woman or implanting an embryo?
Right. So I don't know if he would make that distinction. This was artificial insemination, but this is before IVF. So this is a scenario where they would take the sperm and inject it directly into the uterus. That was the situation at that side. It was not an IVF scenario. It was an artificial insemination scenario. On the other hand, you had Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, whose psak most people basically rely on today, is that unless there is a physical relationship between two individuals, there is no generation of, is no adultery is considered to have transpired, and no mamzerus is considered to be generated in the absence of a physical relationship. And here there is clearly no physical relationship whatsoever. It's just a laboratory procedure of the fertilization of an egg with sperm and then the subsequent implantation. But the following question was then raised: if indeed it is halachically permissible to use donor insemination, is it halachically preferable to use Jewish sperm donor or non-Jewish sperm donor? Now, what do you guys think? What's better, Jewish or non-Jewish?
Non-Jewish.
So this is an educated crowd, so you know the halacha. But the Rav Moshe said, based on his halachic analysis, now don't misinterpret his psak. He wasn't necessarily advocating this procedure. He didn't say everybody should do this procedure. He said, if you're going to do the procedure, it is halachically preferable from a theoretical perspective to utilize non-Jewish sperm versus Jewish sperm. Why? Why? So the answer is because of the fear of consanguinity or potential arias. What does that mean? That means if you have the following situation, that an individual is a sperm donor, and then this person has his own children, his own natural children. And now these two children could possibly meet each other. And there's a famous case, I'm sure there's other cases, and it will share how ridiculous it's become. There's a case of an OBGYN in Israel, who was looking at a newspaper and noticed an announcement for two people about to get engaged. And he said, "Wow, I recognize both families, mazel tov." But then he thought to himself, the reason I recognize both families is because I treated both families for infertility. And he further realized that I treated both for infertility, and they both suffered from male infertility, and both needed sperm donation. And he looked further into his records, and he realized he used the same donor for both families.
Yeah, but the question would be asked to actually say so, because Kevin Shanit Manitma, maybe he doesn't have to reveal that information.
Oh, so does he have to reveal that information? Good kasha. So he actually revealed that information. He thought it was halachically appropriate to reveal that information. Right, so from a health perspective, there may be an issue of creating more genetic disease. And in fact, it's an interesting point for further discussion. Marrying cousins used to be preferable in the Jewish community. Used to be, especially amongst the Hasidic communities, marrying cousins was considered a very positive thing. But because marrying cousins generated more genetic disease, there has been a change in that pattern and in that accepted behavior to now they are not performing these marriages because of this consanguinity creating a genetic disease. Of course, you could say, let the cousins marry each other and let's do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis just to prevent the disease, which by the way, is an answer. Was Rav Moshe's concern... Oh, by the way, so the important question, which is an obvious question you may not realize. So if you have a Jewish man, there's a concern that you might marry a paternal sibling, which would be an Isser Doraisa of Arias. Why is this not a problem if it's non-Jewish sperm? How does that solve the problem?
Esther.
So the reason it solves the problem is for the following reason. So let's say, for example, it's not even an IVF situation. It's a normal relationship. A man has a woman has a relationship with a non-Jewish man and produces a child. The child is 100% halachically Jewish. Who is the halachic father of that child?
Nobody.
Answer? Nobody. From halacha perspective, that child has no halachic father. So for sure the same would be the case for artificial insemination. And if a child has no halachic father, it is impossible to marry a paternal sibling because no such entity exists. So you've solved the problem of consanguinity if you use non-Jewish sperm versus Jewish sperm. So the question is, was Rav Moshe justified in his concern? So I'm just going to read you from the handout. This goes back already a couple years. Cynthia Daly and her partner used a sperm donor to conceive a baby 7 years ago, and they hoped that one day their son would get to know some of his half-siblings. So they went to a sperm bank, and they just got the donor from the sperm bank. But, you know, as the people are socially interested in these kinds of things in the secular society that we live in, she wanted to find if there were other children that were produced from the same donor. If they had any or half-siblings, probably increased people at the Memorial Day barbecue. They didn't have enough family. So Ms. Daly searched a web-based registry for other children fathered by the same donor and helped to create an online group to track them. Today, there are 150 children. 150 children produced by the same donor. And fascinatingly, there is absolutely no legislation in this country limiting the number of donations that can produce children. So it's quite possible that there's far more than 150. It's possible that there's 250. Maybe this is just from one bank. Maybe the donor donated to another bank. And in fact, even in these articles, this was a secular article, nothing to do with halacha whatsoever. Some experts are even calling attention to the increased odds of accidental incest between half-sisters and half-brothers who often live close to one another. Without limits, the same donor could theoretically produce hundreds of related children. And it is even possible that accidental incest could occur among hundreds of half-siblings. So was Rav Moshe correct? Rav Moshe was absolutely correct. The potential is there. Because there
is still a problem. It may not be incest, but the health problem doesn't go away. You still don't want it, even if...
Right. Correct. You still don't want it. But in conclusion, so this is our the last chapter we'll be able to discuss. But in conclusion, we've had an opportunity to discuss some of the great debates in Jewish medical ethics back from the 1500s up to the beginning of the 20th century to towards the late 20th century. Baruch Hashem, we have these conferences to continue the great debates into the future. But who knows what great debates we'll be discussing next year or the year after or the year after. A good Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you
and enjoy.
Okay.